BBC Radio.
BBC Radio 6.
Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with DJ Paulette.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to a brand new episode of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. Music is a natural fire. Take me up, Mr. DJ. I wanna fly. Music is a natural fire. Take me up, Mr. DJ. I wanna fly. Take me up. 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 Today's guest is a DJ, although she's also an author, radio presenter, exhibition curator, PR, poet, mentor, and something of a Mancunian music hero. But her heart has always been behind the decks. Making people move, making people feel, and celebrating the transformative joy of music. A 30-year career has encompassed her legendary residency at the Hacienda, at the club's genuinely groundbreaking gay night, Flesh, plus residencies at Heaven and the Ministry of Sound, and stints in Ibiza and Paris that expanded her creative reach. Now she stands as a trailblazer for female DJs, but also just a damn fine DJ. I'm very pleased to welcome to The First Time today, DJ Paulette. In this show, we talk about Paulette Constable's childhood and family life, surrounded by siblings and a mother who is a singer and who instilled a professional work ethic that she's still got, and of course, a huge and varied range of music. Then there's the teenage years, working in radio, going to gigs of all genres and collecting records, all essential foundations in a path that saw her eventually shape the identity of what was once called Gaychester and eventually playing to thousands of people all around the world. We also discuss her ambitions to expand out of the UK and the triumphs and challenges that followed moving to Europe, and the work she faced re-establishing herself back in her beloved city. But re-establish herself she did, utilising the power of her belief in music. Today we find her a hero to people like Giles Peterson, Jam Supernova and Craig Charles, and she's an author now. Her autobiography, Welcome to the Club, The Life and Lessons of a Black Woman DJ by DJ Paulette, is out now. And you just heard Eat Everything with Get Up, the first track from Paulette's Radio 1 Essential Mix from 2023. But heading back to the beginning, I started by asking DJ Paulette, as I do with all my guests, when was she first aware of music?
I remember that my mum used to put me and my twin in our Silver Cross pram facing each other, and she'd put the radio in between us to stop us crying. And what we'd do was we'd listen to the songs on the radio and we'd be like crying, and then we'd tune up to the track and then we'd start kind of like humming along like babies to whatever tune
that's
was
so
playing
sweet
on the radio. So that's my first real memory, but I don't remember what songs we were humming along to. I just remember that was a habit that we had. And then being little, there was a record that me and my twin planned a dance routine to, and we were so little, we must have been like six or something. And it was a 50s record that my mum had in her 7-inch collection, Up Jumps a Rabbit,
Frankie Lyman
and the Teenagers. Yeah. And we played this record to death. And we just had that moment, Up Jumps a Rabbit. We used to pretend we were rabbits and just bounce around the living room dancing to this track every time it hit that chorus. So that's my first memory.
I was walking along the street.
Bye.
Because your mum was a singer, wasn't she?
Yeah, my mum was a jazz and cabaret singer. She had a band called Blanche Finlay and the Prophets. She put out her album in the 70s, self-produced, and sang a lot of cover versions like Proud Mary and Chains and Gates and all sorts of stuff. And she wrote her own stuff, It's Magic. And she had an album which was called Now Tomorrow, which we were just like, when we were little, we had all these vinyl albums in the house, like, why are these in our cupboard? And we really didn't appreciate what my mum had actually done. And she put this album out in the 70s, and gorgeous picture of my mum on the cover.
Blanche Finlay and the Prophets with their cover of Proud Mary, Blanche Finlay being DJ Paulette's mum. That's a total radio exclusive. Paulette had to ask a friend to sort out a digital rip for us to broadcast. How cool is that? So thank you very much to Matthew Rothery.
You know, my mum was singing every weekend, and she used to do like the Eisteddfod in Wales and lots of jazz festivals, and she was really big. But because it's your mum,
you don't think like it's something special, you're just used to it.
Yeah. And when she'd come and pick us up from school, she'd be like dressed like
flamboyant,
and all my friends at school were like, either their mums were housewives or dinner ladies, because this is like the 60s and 70s, so, you know, it was a rare occasion where there was like anyone that was had any kind of, you know, celebrity. Yeah. And certainly not on our street. And my mum would turn up to like parents' days and things with the big fur coat and a massive amazing afro wig and Cleopatra eyes, and we'd just be like, oh. You know, and now I look so like my mum, and like when I'm doing my makeup and I'll do my eyeliner, I'm like, oh. I'm turning into my mum. I am really like my mum.
Another first single that you bought.
My sisters used to buy records.
Yeah, because you've got like eight siblings, haven't you?
I've got one brother, and so there's seven girls and one boy. So I've got six sisters and one brother. And I inherited a lot of music off them.
Right.
Because I'd always go in the living room whenever they were listening to their music, and I'd be like, can I have it? 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 And I'd just pester my sisters until like they gave me whatever single I was asking about. So the single Pop Music by M, mm-hmm, I paid for with my spends, but I didn't go and buy it. My sister Jenny worked at Woolworths.
If you're growing up, that's a good place to work, isn't it?
And Woolworths used to sell records. And she bought that record for me because she knew that I really loved it. And I said, can you go and get it for me? And the album that I remember buying with my paper round money was Human League.
Okay.
Well, actually, the 12-inch was Sound the Crowd that I bought with my Paper Round money. And I bought an older Human League album, Travelogue and Reproduction, with my Spence. I like old Human League. I also got Dare later on when that came out, but I bought Travelogue, Reproduction and Sound of the Crowd.
You sang in bands as well, didn't you?
Yeah, really bad bands. But
what I want is, I want terrible band names.
It was a terrible band name, that's what I said. It's Bernie Hot Hot.
What?
Bernie Hot Hot. I mean, how bad is that?
That's bad.
And do you know, it's funny, because I met the drummer for the band when I was working for Piccadilly Radio.
Yeah.
I used to work in the record library, and David Dunn, he was like interning, working on a charity thing for New Heart, New Start. And we got talking and he said, oh, you know, I'm auditioning for a band that I'm in, because he's a really good drummer. And he said, oh, you know, we're doing some auditions down in some arches. And I can't even remember where the arches were now, but I went for an audition and I remember singing a jazz standard. You know, you go for an audition for a really contemporary band and just go and
doing
sing.
Doing some Nina Simone.
Nina Simone, it was.
Nice.
It was something like that, or an Ella Fitzgerald thing, or some Cole Porter thing. And anyway, they gave me the part, and I was the second lead singer for this band, and Bernie Hot Hot, and we did... We did loads of Stevie Wonder covers. I'm just laughing because our hearts were in the right place.
Even if your abilities weren't.
No. We were good.
Right.
We were really, really good. It was a band of really great musicians. And I am a trained musician as well. I was trained to play the violin and the guitar and the piano. You know, I was in orchestras till I was 14 and started clubbing and thought, the violin doesn't really make the sound that I wanted to make. But we sang at the International 1 and 2. We supported Deacon Blue one time and we supported Curtis Mayfield another time.
Wow.
So, you know, we had our moments, but I would not want a demo to serve.
Well, we've got one. No, we haven't.
Don't terrify me.
We haven't.
No, please not.
So was it like falling in love with the club aspect of music that maybe made you think, well, the band thing, okay, we've gone as far as that, but hang on, this world is more appealing. Was that how it worked?
Now, no, what happened was I also spent years, because I met my partner in fact, recording a demo with Bernie Hot Hot in Out of the Blue Studios. My partner is a sound engineer. And so for years, I sang backing vocals for lots of bands in studios, and we recorded together and we wrote songs together for years. So people always ask me, you know, oh, were you raving for the second Summer of Love? And I actually flipped out of clubbing around 88 and spent a lot of time in recording studios with my partner writing tunes, because we were going to hit the big time. We were going to be like, you know, well, that never happened. The less we say about that, the better. But I kept getting fired from bands because I'm not a backup singer. You know, I don't have that gene to drift into the background.
You belong at the front of the stage.
Yeah, and what was happening was I was singing with lots of bands where, you know, when I'm in a rehearsal, I'd dress and I'd be like casual in jogging bottoms and a sweatshirt, and then I'd turn out for the gig. turn out for the gig and I'd be like, ta-da! And they'd be like, oh, you're not a backing singer. And then they'd fire me. So
harsh.
When I discovered DJing, all of a sudden, this thought occurred to me that I could perform and entertain people with a musical soundtrack that I created from lots of other people's music, but it was unique to me. So I'm not producing, I'm not making the tunes, but I'm making the soundtrack for the night in my own way and performing it in my own way. And I could be like next generation performer and nobody could fire me. Because it was down to me. And it was down to me what I played, how I played it, where I played, you know, because I didn't have anyone saying, oh, we've got to go to Liverpool and play in this, whatever. I could decide where I played and where I didn't play and how I played it. And this was this new DJ world where there was absolutely nobody like me to set the standard. It was just like, I can do this. And that's the start of everything. And I did the first party at the number one and then followed that up with a Hacienda.
So the first set was 92 at the number one.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is there a track from that era or that set that we could play here that will kind of show us where your head was at when you first stepped up?
I mean, there's loads of tracks, really, but well, it's a diva, Musical Freedom.
At the Hacienda, to people that maybe don't know about how kind of important that night was for loads of reasons.
Yeah, loads.
You know, if you could explain
socially,
a little bit about
socially, culturally, yeah, historically.
So, what was it first of all?
It was the first LGBTQI plus night that the Hacienda had run in its first 9 years of operation. It had never had a gay night, and to contextualise that, gay anything in the world at that time was pariah. The actual intensity of the AIDS crisis is still in the ether. New York clubbing has almost crashed because everybody is dying. AIDS is a gay disease in terms of how our government sees it. And they've put out this advertising, which is just like, it's a gay disease. So if you were even gay and anyone knew you were gay, you'd get spat on the street, called the most hideous names. You know, I interviewed somebody in my book and he said somebody set his hair on fire on the bus. That's how it was. So for a club to take gay anything out of the basements, because that's where we were in the basements of clubs, Rembrandt, Thompson's, you know, there was a circuit, but it was very hidden. And the Hacienda took that place and put it in the centre of town. But it was on the last Wednesday of every month. It wasn't at the weekend. It wasn't a safe night anyway. And I think the Hacienda had a Friday night and a Saturday night anyway. So last Wednesday of every month, flesh became like the centre of the clubbing calendar. But what it did in putting it there, any difference in the centre of any city, London, Manchester, you name it, was pushed to the outskirts. And flesh put it in the centre of town, a night that attracted a queer community from all over the UK. So it was the first time it had really tried to integrate the tribes, but also do something that was really special and really different, and make it in such a way that this thing, this gayness that everybody thought was dirty, it made it so cool because it was openly discriminatory as well. The posters had, it was for dykes, queers and their friends. So if you weren't going in with a dyke or a queer and you couldn't prove you were a friend to the community, you weren't getting in. So it made it so cool that straight people would kiss their best mates on the door to prove they were gay so that they could get in. It's absolutely smashed that thing about gayness being dirty. It has made gayness cool. And how do you do that when you've got Section 28, which says you can't write about anything same-sex in the press, in a book, you can't talk about it in education, you can't talk about it in the media? And all of a sudden, the media wanted to talk about flesh.
What's the track?
Pride of Deeper Love, Clavelis and Cole.
Yeah.
The other thing that I like about that is that that night it began to musically infuse into everything else the Hacienda was doing, yeah. and thus all around the country. So as well as being socially brilliant, the more important thing, musically, the attitude, the openness, the freedom, the eclecticism, the celebration, fashion, the fashion, all...
The look of it.
All started being felt in different clubs.
Yeah, because, you know, remember as well, when we started Flesh, Manchester was associated with baggy pants...
Dour black and white photos.
Hair, you know, ravers, you know, that kind of fashion, Gyogoi, you know, you name it. And then when Flesh came, it became John Richmond, Destroy, Vivian Westwood, Pam Hogg, all these different designers and shapes and looks of it. Suddenly, Manchester became about a lot more than the Stone Roses and In Spiral Carpets. Manchester became a lot more musically rich, a lot more culturally diverse. And, yeah, it all had a very gay edge to it. And we're proud of that.
Let's do another first time in Ibiza. What was your first trip like? Because everyone remembers their first trip.
Yeah, I do. And I went late as well. So I was working for Manifesto and Talking Loud, doing the press for them. And Eddie Gordon, in his infinite wisdom, had told the management that we needed to go out to Ibiza and give all our records to the DJs, which we did. We were at the forefront of promoting records in different areas where, you know, where you knew you were going to get lots of people who were going to come home and buy those records that they heard on the dance floor. So it was the beginning of promoting records like that. So Eddie Gordon had tried to persuade the management that we needed, in fact, it was the entire record label. So press, A&R, marketing. It's like, I want to take the entire personnel to Ibiza to do this thing. And the management were like, no, we don't agree. So every department paid for the one person that was going. They paid for the flight, but they didn't pay for the accommodation. So what we did was we all ordered a load of merchandising. We ordered a load of merchandising, took loads of promos out, T-shirts, bags, you name it, slip mats. I mean, we literally took everything with a Manifesto branding on it that wasn't nailed down, screwed down or fixed to the wall. And what we did, we set up a stall at the entrance of Amnesia on the night of this party, and we literally sold every single bit of merchandising that we'd taken out to Ibiza to pay for the accommodation and the food and whatever else we bought for the staff for the week that we were out in Ibiza. And that was my first trip to Ibiza, and I was playing in Amnesia with Andy Carroll and Norman Jay, and I was in the garden, and Luke Neville and Judge Jules were playing in the main room.
And the track?
I mean, I'd have to pick something from Manifesto. Oh, I mean, it's got to be Gusto, Disco's Revenge. Ha! That's a great tune, very relevant. Yeah, let's pick that one.
We'll be right back. This is The First Time. I'm Matt Everett, and there'll be more from my guest, DJ Paulette, coming up after this.
Hugh Stevens.
Yes, I could bang on about it's a show all about music, but I also speak to some great guests like Ezra Koenig.
Recording in the little studio in Maida Vale.
Last Dinner Party.
How did I find myself in this particular bizarre situation?
Brittany Howard.
Rhythm, to me, is the cornerstone of everything.
I test your music knowledge with the Music Quiz Generator. We dissect the anatomy of music we love in Six Musicology. We review the latest music in Round Table, and we play some incredible tunes on the 5 o'clock home run. How's that?
Hugh Stevens.
Tuesday to Friday afternoons from 4 on Six Music.
Six.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
It's Matt Everett's The First Time with DJ Paulette.
Six Music.
It was a very high octane time for DJs.
Yeah.
Clubbing was flourishing. Phenomenal. Punters were paying. There was a lot of money around.
Yeah,
there was
loads.
A lot of events.
Excess.
There was a lot of excess. There was a lot of behaviour that would be perhaps deemed as being not necessarily the best.
Bad behaviour.
Best for one's well-being at times. How did you negotiate that? Because it's
I
it's
say
not...
well, but also very badly. I just got into it. I just got into it, really, and handled it as best as I could on the sober days.
On the one hand, a lot of fun, a lot of expectation,
yeah,
though.
And a lot of people didn't come back from that.
Exactly.
Because it was really a life of burning the candle at both ends. And at the weekends, I was DJing Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And then in the week, I was doing PR for
a
record
job.
Label. I haven't got a proper job. So I'm working 7 days a week. I just never got any time off. And I was so burnt out. There were just times when I was just like a basket case because it was relentless. It was just so busy and so fast paced. I would say between 96 and 2000, even 2001, it passed in an absolute blur.
Is that part of the reason why Paris became an idea, was to change the backdrop a little bit?
Well, Paris came around for lots of reasons. I'd always been intrigued by France. I was always really interested in the little French films that they used to show on BBC Two and Belle and Sebastian and all those kind of things that were on telly that were French. So I'd always been, like, curious. And that curiosity for all things French kind of endured through the years. And around 2000, I think it was 2001, I was taken on as a resident, international tours resident for the Ministry of Sound. And I started to tour France with them and all around the departments. But I was playing a lot in Paris and Bordeaux and, you know, various key spots. And I really liked it. And I had the ear for the language. And I thought, you think you're hot kitty from the city. So I really get this place. I really love it. So I started to harbour a plan around 2000, 2001 about, could I live out here? And then I sold my flat and I moved. I met someone and I thought, yeah, I met someone French as well. And we kind of dated for 2 years. And then I thought, oh, I should commit to this, as women do.
But you said, like, those years, musically, as a DJ, that was some of the most important years of your life.
2000, 2001, I'm touring for the Ministry of Sound. I put an album out on Nervous Records as well, so I just felt more international about myself. Looking back on it, I wasn't that international. I wasn't as international as I thought I was. And there was something else happening as well, that DJing for women was changing.
Right.
There was this new culture for female DJs, and female DJs were being marketed to white straight men. It was the ladette kind of lad mag culture where you had to look a kind of way and you had to be a certain way in order to fit in. And I did not fit into any of those boxes. I'm a black woman who plays quite soulful vocal house and I can get quite hard, but it's got a black music thread running through it like a stick of dynamite. I wasn't playing like, and trance was suddenly becoming super, super popular.
Sure.
2000, 2001. So my music wasn't working either. I started to really struggle in the UK, but I was doing super well in Europe. So it just made more sense to me. Like, why stay here and struggle when I'm selling my flat and we're going to have all this cash in the bank and I can just go and explore somewhere new in France? I don't even speak the language. No, my family were like, she'll be back in 6 months. 10 years later. In France for, it was getting into my 10th year, I had the opportunity to naturalise myself and I just knew I love the country. I really do love the country and that will never change, but I can never be French because I haven't got the cultural knowledge, I haven't got the cultural thing in my DNA to know how to construct the perfect French sentence when I'm sitting in a business meeting, to when I'm talking to somebody's parents, to when I'm talking to the doctor, because your language changes every single time. It's not like English where the language is really consistent. How you talk to a teacher or a head, you're still using the same nuances of language. But in French, it changes for every single person or conversational transactions, they're all so different. And I was struggling, you know, I can speak French, but I can't be French. And I didn't want to be anyway. I'm from Manchester, you know, that's everything to do with, you know, the reasons why they loved me when I got there was I wasn't playing French.
Yep.
I had a different sound and I will always have a different sound because I'm English. Those are my influences and I am proud of that. And I'm from Manchester and I am proud of that. And I was not in any way, shape or form. And this is not being xenophobic at all. This is because I know who I am and I'm English. So what did I do? I moved to Spain. Because I wasn't ready to come home. I moved to Spain thinking, oh, I'm going to be really famous in Ibiza and everybody will love me. And they didn't. And it was a big disaster. And, you know.
What happened?
There is a thing in life called planning. And we all have to do that regardless of who we are, where we are or what we're doing. There has to be an element of the plan. And I remember saying to my sister when I was moving to Ibiza, she said, well, what are you going to do if it goes wrong? And I went, there's no plan B. I move, I play music and that's it. And she's like, but what if, you know, I'm like, shut up. And she was right. You know, what are you going to do if it goes wrong? And I didn't have a network around me that was going to catch me if I failed. The network I had around me was too fragile and they weren't connected enough or engaged enough with me to anchor me when I needed to be anchored. So it kind of was a very great eye-opener, but I learned some skills there, playing in bars, very long sets, not very much money, that actually gave me the basis for rebuilding my career. Because one of the problems with Ibiza is that it's seasonal, so you can only work 3 months a year. I mean, you've got to work hell for leather for 3 months because you know for the next 9 months there's no work coming in. So unless you've got another full-time job, you are going to really struggle. And I really struggle because the rents there and everything are extortionate. And I learn how to, well, budget. And I also learn how to play long sets in bars for people that are eating. And when I came back to Manchester, my first meeting was with Sasha Lord. He was totally lovely, but he's like, I can't give you any work because nobody knows who you are anymore and you're going to have to do... I mean, he was honest. He was, but he was right. You know, I'd spent 10 years in London and another 10 years in Paris and 2 years. So it's nearly 23 years out of the English circuit. He gave me a lot of people. He's like, you know, why don't you go and speak to this person, that person, whatever. And I bumped into a friend as I was going to the dentist, having a really bad day. And I bumped into Nick D'Souza, who owns a place called Tariff and Dale in Manchester. And he said, why don't you come and play at my birthday party? It's the first birthday party of Tariff and Dale. It was May 2016. And I hadn't done any DJing between getting to Manchester in December and May. And I was like, yeah, why not? And I did that party and all of the bookers for the bars in Northern Quarter and also all of Manchester were there. So I started building up this network of people that from getting to Manchester and realising that I didn't know anybody at all, I was building a network of people and contacts.
What's the song, what was the track that you can remember playing in one of those smaller places, one of those restaurants, and thinking, I can do this, I can get back from here, I know where I'm heading?
Yeah, it was, oh my gosh, yeah, Disclosure, Holding On. It was a Gus Parelli remix that I used to play all the time when I was a resident at Pikes in Ibiza. I used to play that record non-stop.
Music Festival.
2024.
Bringing you artists like you've never seen them before.
And you can listen back to all your favourite festival moments featuring
Hack Baker, Young Fathers, C-Mat, Gossip, Jordan Rackline and The Smile.
Plus DJ sets, as well as some of the brightest and best new talent from BBC Introducing.
Relive all the performances from this year's Six Music Festival. Watch on iPlayer. Listen on BBC Sounds. Just search for Six Music Festival.
BBC Radio. BBC Radio 6 Music.
It's Matt Everett's The First Time with DJ Paulette. Six
Music. Tell me about Homebird.
Yeah, now that was the start of a lot of very interesting exhumation of memories.
This is also kind of where the reality of this broad vision of what you do now, you know, mentoring and writing, which we talk about, I mean, all these kind of things, it's like...
Yeah, it was the bringing together of every side of me that I had split.
So this is at the Lowry, right?
Yeah. So it's at the Lowry Art Gallery. And it was a funny thing because it came about because Michael Simpson, who is the director of the Lowry, had read a poem that I'd put on my WordPress called I Am The One. And I just put it out there and didn't think about it because I thought nobody ever reads my blog anyway. You know, I can see all I ever get from it is Russian spam. So it's like, who reads my poems? But somebody actually did. And he emailed me and said, I've read your poem. I really like it. I want you to come in and talk to us about doing a gallery interruption for us. I'm like, I've never done anything like that before. And I'm very like this anyway. People set me a challenge and I go, I don't know how to do that, but it's a really great thing to do. And it is something that I really want to do and I think could be quite cute. So we talked about what I would do as an exhibition. And they said, you know, you've got all these ideas, but we need to make it art. So I'm like, well, growing up, my experience as a young black girl brought up in white Jewish and white Irish areas. So what were my experiences and what were the experiences of my family? So I want that on the first wall. And then the second wall, I want work, connections. How did I grow up in Manchester? So we did a radio and a TV wall. And then education, because I've been educated all the way through the education system. So we had a book wall and we made original art videos out of my poems. And I made a TV wall because TV has everything to do with what my experience as a black person in England has been. Not seeing very many people like me, the people that I saw who were like me that have influenced me massively. So we created this fake page of the Radio Times with all the programmes that when you actually looked at it, it's like, oh, that was never a schedule. This is the programmes, all the programmes that I've logged and I've had to watch and watch and watch because there were black people in them. So it was started with Sesame Street in the morning and then Floella Benjamin on Play Away and then the news with Moira Stewart and Trevor McDonald. You know, those people were really key for a black person because they're kind of voices of authority, not robbers and drug addicts in bit parts in dramas. You know, it's like these people were really key. So we had this wall as a TV wall and then we made a fake perfume ad because you don't see black people in advertising. And it was really clever and very nuanced and loads of levels. And I think if I were to put that out in 2024, people would see it with a whole set of different eyes because what I didn't have when I did that exhibition was a hashtag Black Lives Matter. It didn't exist in 2018, but if I put that hashtag on it, it would make a whole load more sense. It was just a brilliant opportunity to express my experiences of being first generation Black British, because that's who I am, in art. And poetry and music and show what my experiences were as a black TV presenter, as a black radio presenter, as a black female DJ, as just a black person in this entire world with a family who are all first generation black British and whatever our experiences were. So we are like the Windrush generation. So, you know, my parents came over as immigrants and that was the experience. You know, that's what the exhibition was about, the black experience in Manchester and in Britain and in the world, according to DJ Paulette. And it really laid the foundations for the book, which came 3 years later. I was commissioned to write a book, and that was, yeah.
This brings it up to the present day, your first book.
Yeah, my first book.
What's the joke, isn't it? It's just like, oh, I'm writing a book. Oh, neither am I. Because everyone says that they're going to do it,
yeah,
or they can do it. And actually, putting the years in and pulling apart your life and looking at it on the page, you learn a lot.
Yeah.
But it's a very difficult thing to do. How was that experience for you?
Yeah, it was deep. Yeah, and I use the word deep in every sense of the word because I had to dig really deep to, first of all, to tell a story that would be interesting to lots of people to read, because I didn't want to write a straight chronological DJ biography. Then I did this, and then I spoke to this person, and I was in the green room with this person. Because to me, I mean, I'm a reader and I'm also an academic. I'm an art student. I did my degree at Manchester Met. So I have a different interest in books when I read them to people who will pick up a DJ book and just want to read it on the beach. I didn't want to write a beach read. I wanted to write a book that would change people's perceptions of the job. I've been in the business for 30 years and I have seen it change from writing a record on the back of a fag packet and singing it to the people in the record shop, if you could even remember how it went. But now you can Shazam it. Now you can get it on any streaming service. You had to buy a record if you wanted it 30 years ago. Now you can get any DJ set in an instant. You can download every tune that Sven Vaith played yesterday and you can have it.
I mean, there's a lot about that that I love and there's a lot about that that I don't like.
Listen, even now you could make a tune that David Guetta might make. You don't even have to be David Guetta to make a David Guetta tune anymore. Thank you, AI. You know, within a couple of weeks of my book being out, there is a second version which has been made by AI. It's not written by me. It's not been authorised. It's second on the list in Amazon and it's 58 pages long. Thank you, AI. Nothing we can do about it. So these are the changes that I wanted to put in the book. It's not just a DJ book. It's a book about past, present and future. It's a history book in its own little way. It's a how-to manual. It's a how-not-to manual, definitely, because I've had a lot of how-not-tos. But it's also a really positive overview of what it's taken to create this industry and culture from scratch, because it didn't exist.
And the very final thing, we'd like you to pick the last track. What should we go out on? Everybody always hates this question.
Because it feels like you're doing something down by forgetting and by going for one thing over another. But I'm just remembering one of the highlights of my last year. There were two sets that were highlights. One of them was back-to-back with Bless Madonna at Homo Blog in Manchester, and that was enormous. But the set I'm going for is San Remo at Glastonbury. And I played Leo and Bushwhacker's Love Song versus Finally. And it was a Paul Wolford remix. And it absolutely tore that tent apart. It was my last record. And Finally is, it's Julie McKnight on vocals. It's just a classic house record anyway. But with Love Story, rather, and Finally as the bootleg, but then remixed by Paul Wolford. And it was just a moment in time that was just so special. And my nephew is at Glastonbury and he said, oh, I'm going to come and listen to you, Auntie Paulette. I love it when they say that. I'm in the green room trying to be all Miss Kitty from the city and all special, and they shout Auntie Paulette across the green room. I think that's nice. So he was there and he bought not one friend, but 20 friends with him to listen to his Auntie Paulette at Glastonbury. And I had them in the back. And I never have anyone with me in the DJ booth because I'm just like that. I don't like it. But when I saw him and all his mates, I was like, ooh. And it brought a tear to my eyes. So it has to be that record. And happy 30th birthday, Luke, because it's his 30th birthday this year.
And that's the song we're going to go out on. It's been a pleasure to speak to you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's been smashing. Thank you so much, Matt.
Thank you. Leo and Bushwhacker, Love Story versus finally the Paul Woolford 2023 remix. The final choice of my guest on The First Time today, DJ Paulette. And that is the end of this show and the end of this series of The First Time. You can, of course, listen back to previous First Time shows from the archive, including my conversations with Tom York, Dave Grohl, Elton John, Janelle Monáe, and all the new episodes from this series, which include Phil and Paul from Orbital, Ezra Koenig from Vampire Weekend, and Self-Esteem, Rebecca Lucy Taylor. We will be back with more First Time shows very soon, but until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
To your favourite Six Music shows on the BBC Sounds app.
Right now, it's the New Music Fix playlist. before the zoo is such a bleak sunrise.